For CJLO News, this is Ahmed Mujtahid. In Montreal, mental health issues were found to be a factor in more than half of all the cases involving the use of deadly police force, as stated by CBC. Consequently, the Montreal Police Service will train all its patrol officers to use tools that will help them deal with those suffering from mental health issues. Patrol officers will take a one-day training session to learn how to de-escalate tense situations and improve their conflict resolution skills. According to documents presented at the city's Public Security Committee, the training will include both theoretical discussions and real-life examples. Officers will also be trained on how to use verbal skills to create a non-threatening environment for those who are suicidal or in crisis. Several people who attended the meeting said they were skeptical that a one-day course could really change police culture. A coordinator of the Ligue des Droits et Libertés said, "One day of training is not enough, and police need more training so that their weapon is not their first option." The Trudeau government is proposing to prevent asylum seekers from making refugee claims in Canada if they have made similar claims in certain other countries, including the US, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. The move comes as thousands of asylum seekers have crossed the Canadian border after their claims were rejected in the US. Border Security Minister Bill Blair said the measure aims to prevent asylum shopping. Lawyers and advocates who work with refugees are sounding the alarm about the legal changes, saying they would strip human rights protections from vulnerable asylum seekers. Demonstrations in Sudan's capital have been gaining intensity in recent days. According to activists involved in the demonstration, security forces killed at least 14 people on April 9. At least 8 others have been killed since last week. Sudan has been the site of protests since late December, when a protest began over the price of bread. The economic concerns have become political demands, and protesters want an end to the 30-year rule of President Omar al-Bashir. Women in particular have played a striking role in the Khartoum protests. The US, Britain, and Norway released a joint statement that called on Sudan's government to respond to protesters' demands and deliver a credible plan for political transition. To hear the newscast and learn more about the news team, visit cjlo.com/news.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. In the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping. With folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5. What a way.
I feel like the subject is a very important subject that we have to cover, and it deals with the Rwandan genocide, the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, and the trauma that the survivors faced afterwards.
Yeah.
I think that many times we tend to, I would say, suppress our emotions when we deal with trauma. And this is not a healthy thing to do, of course. We have to talk about it. There's got to be a conversation that happens about it. What do you think, Erdine?
Yeah. But just before we jump into the topic, I want to give a trigger warning, just because, as Christina mentioned, we are talking about a very heavy subject, and it can be uncomfortable for some people. So today's topic deals with violence, assault, mentions of rape. So please, if you are uncomfortable with that, feel free to just, you know, take a minute, you know, come back if you want. So yes, just that. So like Christina talked about it, I think definitely when we were both reading about this and like learning more about this issue, like for me personally, even reading about it, I felt a lot, and I felt really sad.
Yeah, there was a whole myriad of emotions that just came through us.
Yeah.
You know, you were at the same time, like, we're in despair, but we're also like happy for the people who survived such a terrible time. You know, it's never easy dealing with situations like this.
Yeah.
Because of there's such a duality in our emotions, right? And I feel like we hope that this show will help you, will open your eyes to maybe the importance of therapy and, you know, just talking, having a discussion about people in the wake of a traumatic event.
Yeah.
Right?
And also, one of the reasons why I wanted to personally have this today's the Rwandan genocide as today's topic is because on April 7th, it was the 25th, 25th year since the genocide. And I was online and I was searching for stuff and I was looking into it, but there wasn't a whole lot of media coverage. The media wasn't really talking about it in depth. And there is a article that we referenced today from The Atlantic, but that article is from 2015. So it wasn't like very recent, and just the fact that the 25th year was just on April 7th and there hasn't been a lot, it was a little disappointing, because these things are very important for us to always remember. And you know, just it's not something that we should forget. It still exists in many people's hearts, that trauma is real. But before we get into like talking about everything, like the trauma and everything, I just want to give a little background of the Rwandan genocide. So the Rwandan genocide was a mass killing of the Tutsi people during a period of 100 days from April 7th, 1994 to July 15th. Approximately 800,000 Rwandans were slaughtered by Rwandan military and the Hutu militia. And additionally, 30% of the Batwa, one of the main ethnic groups in Rwanda, was also killed. The genocide ended when the Tutsi-backed the Rwandan Patriotic Front, led by Paul Kagame, took control of the city. The genocide was during the Rwandan Civil War, which was a struggle between the Hutu and the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front. And during that time, during the Civil War, there was a lot of anti-Tutsi propaganda that was alive. And this was partially because the political elite in Rwanda at the time was Hutu. They were Hutu people. So they kind of like spread this, anti-Tutsi propaganda, like I said, during that time. And the people in Rwanda had a very extreme opposition to the Tutsis. So the origin of the genocide and how the genocide actually began during the Civil War was on April 6th, an airplane carrying the Hutu president Cyprien was shut down above his house while the plane was on its way to the capital city of Kigali. The very next day, and some even say like within the next hours, the leaders of the Hutu political scene, they began planning the genocide. There were barricades and checkpoints set up where people had to show their ID cards, which had the ethnic groups written on them. So it was very easy to identify who was Hutu, who was Tutsi. So this made it possible to carry out the killings very systematically. I think from the very beginning, it was very highly organized from what I was reading, with the leaders from Kigali, the main city of Rwanda, calling out to and sending messages to the leaders of the provinces and leaders of the villages. And in turn, those leaders in the provinces and villages and other cities, they armed the civilians and they armed the people there to go out and start this genocide and go mass slaughter the Tutsi people. And in the villages and countryside, regular civilians were the ones who carried out these killings. And this was, even though there wasn't like the whole lot of like systematic barricades and stuff as in the cities, it was very easy because these regular civilians lived side by side. So it was very easy to know who was a Tutsi and who was a Hutu. And one interesting thing that I found was the Hutu people who refused to kill the Tutsis were branded as sympathizers, and they themselves risked being executed. And, you know, oftentimes they were executed if they refused to carry out their leader's orders. Yeah. And in so the UN released a special report in 1996, and it was written by René Denis Segui, and he stated, and this is a quote from this report, quote, "Rape was the rule and its absence was the exception. Rape was systematic and was used as a weapon." So, and in his report, he also talks about how rape was a method of force and threat and how they used it as a way to like eliminate the Tutsis and like kind of attack their moral during the genocide. And I think honestly this was one of the most heartbreaking things for me when I was reading it. And another thing that was really messed up was during the conflict, the Hutu extremists actually released hundreds of patients suffering from AIDS from the hospitals and formed these rape squads where they would like force them and like make them go out and like rape Tutsi women so that, you know, like they like carry this on generations. And
that's terrible.
This effect of like systematic raping and like spreading AIDS resulted in a lot of families with like single moms and just like orphan children. And also because the Hutu wanted to stop the Tutsi reproduction, a lot of women, on top of being raped really brutally, they were mutilated, especially their like reproductive organs, their vaginas. They suffered a lot. Like some of them had like acid thrown on them, like, you know, just like butchered. And yeah, so that's a little background about everything. And just another thing, during the genocide, over the period of 100 days, the UN was actually, there was a UN presence in Rwanda because they had been there for the civil war, which had started in 1993. Yet they really did nothing to stop or interfere. And like I said, the Tutsi, the Hutu war and like the genocide ended when the Tutsi-backed government kind of took control of the city. And I mean, there are a lot of like reports on what the UN did, what the West did, but I just like didn't bother because the fact is they did nothing and they just watched over a million people get slaughtered. And no matter how many reports they release, the fact remains the same. And Canada is the same. Canada didn't really do anything. So, yeah.
Neither did the U.S.?
No, no. Of course they wouldn't
do anything.
And the thing is, like, they were aware of this. They were aware of the genocide happening.
Of course.
Yeah.
They were totally aware.
Yeah.
And stood by and did not lift a finger.
No, they really did not. And it's...
That's terrible.
Yeah, it really, really sucks. Yeah. But, you read this article.
Yeah, I read this article, and it's on The Atlantic, and it talks about basically the repercussions of this genocide on she was very young at the time. She was 14 years old.
So the journalist went to Rwanda and talked to a survivor.
Yes.
Yes.
Lisa Wolf.
Yeah.
She spoke with Consuli Nishimwe. My pronunciation is probably off, but that's all right. So this woman, at the time she was 14, she got brutally raped by this man that she knew. He was a neighbor. And he raped her in the house that, in an abandoned home that she hid away in to hide from the Hutu militia. And this happened, and she had to carry that burden with her for years after that. Imagine, from 1994 till 2001, until she moved to New York. She never spoke about what had happened. She remained quiet. She was very introverted. It was terrible. Yeah. And she had to live with those consequences. Yeah. And how do you live with that? How do you survive that?
It's difficult.
It's so difficult.
I can't even imagine, because we both of us haven't been through that. Yeah.
But her attitude was, there could be worse. Yeah. There could be worse things happening. Yeah. She just suppressed her emotions. It's incredible.
After the break, we have a little break now, and after the break we'll be talking to Jackie Batsanduka, who is a director, producer, writer, amazing, extraordinary goddess in general, and she has a project called Geni, and she talks about like Geni and how it relates to the Rwandan genocide. So don't go away, you're listening to Sparkling Introspection on CGLO 1690 AM.
The time has come to recognize the best of Montreal. Support community radio and local music by voting for CJLO and our DJs for best radio station, radio show, and radio host in Cult Montreal's annual Best Of poll. Let's get CJLO to number one. Vote online at cultmontreal.com.
Femme AM is Concordia's only feminist talk show. We shed light on gender issues in your community that affect you through interviews and discussions. Give us a listen every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. only on CGLO 1690 AM.
Victoria Weekend goes live at Club Soda on Sunday, May 19th with A Taste of Reggae. One amazing concert featuring three incredible live bands jamming at Club Soda on Victoria Holiday Weekend, Sunday, May 19th. Doors open at 7 p.m. Performing will be Meta and the Cornerstones alongside Ilem and Inus Aso. This is a show you will not want to miss.
Hello, I'm Rich Jason. Do you think all electronic music is the same? On Rigged Sessions, we play everything, from the most energetic to the calm, from the euphoric to the gloomy, from the cutting edge of the music scene to tracks that have stood the test of time, from 100 BPM to 180 BPM, and everything in between. Plus, you'll get to listen to a weekly mix performed live by me. Rigged Sessions is on air every Thursday from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock PM Eastern, live only on CJLO 1690 AM and on CJLO.com.
Hello, this is Christina. You are listening to Sparkling Introspection on CJLO 1690. So before, we were discussing how we're going to interview Jackie. Now, oh my goodness.
Yeah, yes. So before the break, we were talking about the Rwandan genocide and basically like all the trauma that comes with it. And we gave a little background of it. Basically, the Rwandan genocide it happened in 1994 over a period of 100 days. And it was when the Hutu, like one of the main ethnic groups in Rwanda, were killing another main ethnic group, the Tutsis. So right now we have Jackie Batsanduka, who is a director, a creative, a goddess, a producer, a writer, an actor, just all around amazing person. And so Jackie's just going to like give us a little information about her and her like her project Geni and like how the genocide has affected her. So, hi, Jackie.
Hi.
How are you today, tonight?
I'm good, Ardine. How are you?
I'm very, very well. Thank you for joining us, first of all.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Okay. So before anything, can you just introduce yourself? Like, who are you? Why are you relevant to this topic, etc.?
Yeah, well, as Ardeen said, I'm a woman that wears a lot of hats. I guess I kind of refer to myself as a filmmaker. I'm based in Montreal. I just graduated from the Communication Studies program at Concordia, and I'm pursuing a career in film, doing all kinds of stuff. And my film, Genny, is the first project that I'm doing outside of university. And I wanted to make something that was really meaningful to me as the first thing that really, like, represents who I am as a filmmaker. So I chose to write about what I know, which is being the child of two survivors of the Rwandan genocide. And so that's kind of where Genny came from, and now it's grown into something bigger and bigger and more meaningful, and I'm really excited to see how everything turns out.
Mm-hmm. How did you find out about the genocide?
Well, like I said, growing up, the child of two genocide survivors, two Rwandan genocide survivors, it was always just a thing that, you know, we knew. In our community, which for us, I was born in Ottawa and kind of moved around Ontario and Quebec, but really Ottawa was like the main hub. And it's where we had most of our family friends who were also survivors who were, you know, refugees coming over to Canada and settling in Ottawa. So we had this community of people that we loved and would have so much fun with and have celebrations with and would hang out with on the weekends. Like, all the kids knew each other, all the parents knew each other. It was like one big family. But at the same time, you know, what was so evident was the fact that the reason why we're all here is because our families had to escape this horrible thing that was the genocide in 1994. And although there was a lot of love and a lot of support within this tight-knit group, you couldn't deny the fact that, like, so many people's family members were not there because they had been killed or they were in another country and stuck there or whatever. So the genocide was something that was always kind of in the back of everyone's minds, at least speaking as the child of two survivors. Mm-hmm. Definitely something that was implicit in my, like, upbringing.
Mm-hmm. And was this... Hi, it's Christina.
Hi,
was
Christina.
This trauma... Hi. And was this trauma something that was discussed in your family or your community? Or did you just suppress it?
That's a good question. So within our community, like I said, there was a lot of times where we would come together, whether that was during a celebration, but then also during yearly commemorations for the genocide. So growing up, first of all, I don't speak the mother tongue. So that was a big part of kind of the, like, implicitness of the genocide. So you'd have people who were alive during that time who would be discussing with each other, you know, their experiences, or let's say we're at a commemoration and they're discussing the family members that they've lost and whatever. I can't even tell you what they were discussing. This is based on, you know, just in hindsight, thinking about what they would be saying, because I didn't speak the language. So, you know, you even if you're like a kid who doesn't speak the language, you can pick up the cues of the room. So if someone's standing up and they're talking about whatever, you know, okay, this is a very serious subject. But at the same time, no one is saying those things directly to you in a way that you can understand, you know. So it was kind of like this thing that people talked about around you, a little vaguely, and then you'd want to, like, quickly, at least for me, I'd want to quickly change the subject because I'm like, okay, well, I don't want to see, you know, my mom, my dad, my aunts, my uncle sad. So let's go back to, like, the celebratory part of the evening, you know? Or, like, if we're thinking more in terms of at home, my parents, what's funny is they had a lot of pictures around the house of their family members. Not a lot, I would say, but, like, some pictures that were out and about. So growing up, you know, I'd ask questions. My mom's sister who had passed in the genocide, her name was Jacqueline. I was named after her. And she looked exactly like me.
Wow.
Like, shocking. That's kind of why, when I was a baby, I don't think my mom knew that I would look exactly like her sister. But I was named after her. And then as I grew older and I found a picture of Jacqueline, I was like, oh, I don't remember wearing that dress.
Jacqueline?
Was like, that's not you, that's your aunt. And then there was that moment of like, oh, hang on. I was named after this aunt who passed away, your favorite sister.
Wow. That's powerful.
What does that mean for you? What does that mean for me? Are we going to talk about this right now? Yeah. You know, I'm like, I was maybe, 10 when that situation happened. So there's these moments that are initially like happy moments, remembering a family member, but then the details of why that family member is no longer there were never really talked about.
Yeah.
Right.
So that kind of inspired me to do this project, to explore why these things are not explicitly talked about.
And also to express, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Like how these things are not explicitly talked about, how they're expressed in subtle ways. And in that sense, being able to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Was there, you mentioned that you had the situation with your mom, with seeing your aunt, Jacqueline. Was this one of the moments, or were there any other moments when you were growing up that you really felt or saw the effects of the genocide?
I saw it all over in terms of my community. So, you know, alcoholism is a big thing. Like, general, like, frustration and aggression that, like, I'm thinking more in terms of the men, just because, you know, in any patriarchal society, we all know that men don't really express their emotions well, especially when they've gone through a huge trauma like the genocide. So, you know, it wasn't rare to at all to see men coping through substances, through, you know, big emotional outbursts. In terms of the women, it was, you know, some people would be quite passive, others I think really focused on their families, right? You know, you're starting a new life, you lost the old one, you have to invest and nurture what's in front of you instead of dwelling on what's in the past, but with that comes, you know, somewhat of a denial of what happened. And that resurfaces for sure, you know?
Definitely.
So, yeah, I'd say the film is definitely kind of an amalgamation of the different types of people I know in the community and their different relationships with their family members. And because of what happened to them and what happened to our community after 1994.
Can you tell us, you talked about this film and like Genny, but can you really like go into detail and talk to us about this project, Genny, and like how Genny came about, and also what does Genny mean?
Well, to answer your last question, Genny is the name of the protagonist. which I will be playing. It's short for Mugeni, which means bride in Kinyarwanda, which is the mother tongue of Rwanda. Yeah, I don't want to reveal too much because the story is definitely one that goes in all types of directions, has all types of meanings. So I'll give you a little teaser. It means bride.
Oh, okay.
as for the project itself, I really wanted to write something, like I had said earlier, something quite meaningful coming out of university, especially having a lot more time to write and understand what I'm writing and think about whether or not it's worth all the time and effort that it takes to produce something. So, yeah, I wrote it in the summer after I graduated, and they say to write what you know. So I drew from the people around me, my own family, and created a story that's really about a mother and daughter who are affected by this genocide, and how their relationship begins and develops, and what it can become at the end of something as traumatic as a genocide. So yeah, I wrote that, and then I was assembling my crew in the fall, and it was it's made up of mostly women that I had met at Concordia.
Yay!
The communications program, yeah, which is amazing. I was really conscious of that fact. I didn't want I wanted to make sure I chose people that were starting out in their careers, are super talented, but they're starting out in their careers, so they, like myself, right? Yeah. So this could be a jumping off point for them, I hope, at least.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I've made my crew, and right now we're just in pre-production, getting ready to shoot in the beginning of May. Right now we're also in the middle of our, well, not middle, the tail end of our crowdfunding campaign. So this is mostly self-funded and funded by the people around us that are so graciously donating. We hope to shoot at the beginning of May, and then hopefully you'll see us in some festivals. That's kind of the plan.
I can't wait.
Fingers crossed.
I know I will see Genny in all of the festivals, and I will see this, because this is such an important story to be told and such a personal one. And when you do, like, you know, when you're in post-production and when you are doing your press tour, you know, etc., etc., I hope to have you on the show again.
Yeah.
Of course.
Of course.
Yeah. Love to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anytime.
Yeah. So I've been meaning, this is like a burning question of mine. Mm-hmm. Has this whole entire project, has this been your way of coping with what happened?
Yeah, I'd say so. It's been a really interesting process because the story itself is very much about a child of two survivors confronting how 1994 and the genocide has affected her, despite not having lived through it, but being, you know, intergenerational trauma. So, and, you know, that greatly relates to myself and my position.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting is the fact that my mom is playing opposite me, as the protagonist mother. And we do have a better relationship than the two characters. I will say that now before anyone thinks that I have been estranged from my mother for 5 years. And I'm
FYI.
Confronting her. We would not be making this project if we weren't as close as we are. So that's good. But that being said, it's opened up this line of communication in terms of how she feels about the genocide. And I've learned so much mm-hmm. about her experience with it, and mm-hmm. even the way that she's coping with it today. Like, the 25th commemoration was just this past weekend, and my mom was on CBC describing how she had learned of her family's passing. And she had never shared that story with me. Now imagine she's on, like, national television yeah. talking about this, knowing that myself, my brother, and all these other people are watching at home, and she's sharing this for the first time.
Oh, and that's big.
I think, you know, she was on the air for the Humura Association, which is the survivors advocacy group in the Ottawa-Gatineau region. But I think, I would like to think that part of the reason why she was brave enough to share her story was because we had already done some of the work of opening up and talking about her experiences, and understanding that, you know, now's the time to actually talk about what happened and really confront how it's still affecting you, you know? Yeah. And with every rehearsal, with every conversation we have in regards to this film, I feel like we're getting closer and closer to understanding each other, understanding ourselves, and just starting to heal, you know, in a way that wasn't there before. So if anything, if this film is on my own shelf with dust all over it and no one sees it, at least I can say that myself and my mom have gotten so much closer and have understood each other so much better. And I've just become more and more appreciative of who she is and what she's done for me and my family, and what she's gone through. So that's like the biggest thing I can take away from this entire experience.
That's really beautiful. Yeah. And I think it's you said something really important, that like, through this art, that this has been a way for you and your family to kind of heal. And I find for myself personally that art and venturing into art, trying different things, can be such a therapeutic and such a healing experience. So it's mm-hmm. really great hearing you, like, take this on mm-hmm. and actually get something out of it that is so everlasting mm-hmm. and impactful.
Yeah, for sure. And it always helps to talk about things. You always have to open up a conversation about, especially the most traumatic events. Mm-hmm. You have to. Like, that's the only way that you're going to be able to move forward, right? And become a healthier individual, right? Not only physically, but mentally in every aspect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So,
and I think that was always something that was promoted within our community generally. You know, we had yearly commemorations where people come together and there would be a vigil and people mm-hmm. would speak and share their experiences. I think for my family, we're kind of unique in that we would attend, but it wouldn't necessarily always be so clear what people would be saying within my family, you know, because of a language barrier, or because my family just didn't choose to speak. So, but yeah, there was always that encouragement to come forward and share your truth. But I think now, especially, they are, my mom is definitely coming forward and really sharing her truth.
Well, thank you, Jackie, for actually being here with us and talking to us about this. I know it's a really personal project, and thank you for sparing your time. Just before you go, I want to, like, mention one more time that you guys have a GoFundMe that's going on, and how many days are left?
We have 5 days left.
Mm-hmm. And where can people find details? Like, is it on your Instagram, Facebook page?
Yeah. So we have a Facebook and an Instagram page. We're pretty active on there. So on Facebook, it's Genni, G-E-N-I, short film. And on Instagram, it's Genni, G-E-N-I, film. yeah, we're always posting on there. And on either of those pages, you can find our Indiegogo campaign. And we're currently at 79% of our goal.
Yay!
Oh, amazing.
So if this is a project that you're all interested to know more about, please check out our social media, check out our Indiegogo page, and please do consider donating, because this is, you know, definitely a project worth supporting. And I don't think you'll be disappointed. Plus, my mom is amazing.
So yeah.
If you want to see my mom.
Yeah, it's a family fair.
Acting debut.
Bring your family.
And also, just like, I think it's so important, even at Sparkling Introspection, I mean, we're a woman-based show. We want to do everything that's woman-related. And it's so important to support female artists and amazing people like you, Jackie, that are actually like sharing your story and putting out the work. And also the whole Genny crew is female.
Well, not the entire.
Oh my God, how could you?
The majority.
Just kidding.
Majority of the people are women.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for your time. We can't wait to see the film.
Cannot wait.
Yeah. So everybody go check out at Genny Film on Instagram and Facebook at Genny Genny Short Film.
Yes.
Yeah, and make sure to donate. It's a worthy cause. Thank you, Jackie, for staying with us. I wish you good luck.
Thank you so much, Ardeen and Christina.
Thank you.
All right. See you later.
Bye-bye. Have a good one. Bye.
Wow.
That was great.
That was really great.
She is so inspirational. This is it. This is what it is, guys. Yeah. You have to... It's called openness through art, through just by talking, just by having a conversation. You cannot contain your emotions. You cannot do that. It is the worst thing possible.
Yeah, and that's very true, because I'm someone who's very much like, I don't really talk about my emotions. Obviously, behind closed doors, I'm a Pisces. Behind closed doors, I go and cry and do my thing. But I always found it hard to like be very honest with myself, be very truthful, and speak the emotions that I'm feeling, especially when they're emotions of like difficult things. Even like right now, talking about it, I can't even find the words to like how to put it. And I think in a lot of cases, in a lot of communities where marginalized communities, like I'm Mongolian, it's hard to speak about
even Italians.
Your feelings.
I'm Italian, and we don't, especially the old generation, we don't go see a psychologist. You know, that's not the way we deal with
things.
I mean,
even just like beyond psychologists, just like talking
or with just
your
talk
family,
about it. Yeah.
It's a little like taboo, like touchy touchy. Oh, you're so emotional.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really, I mean, using the arts can be such a healing way to process your feelings.
Extremely.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
What is an art thing that you do that you
I write poetry. I'm a poet. That's what's in my heart. Yeah, I just spill out all my feelings, my experiences through my poetry.
Yeah.
And that's really helped me. Maybe it's like ground myself or center myself.
Yeah. For sure.
Because your body, right, can only take so much. You can only take so much pain.
Hundo.
We're human beings, we're very strong. Extremely strong. But
that's true.
We have a breaking point.
Yep.
You know? And it's at that moment that you have to be truthful to yourself. You say, you know, I have a problem.
Yeah.
I am emotionally unstable. You know, I need to get the proper help.
Yeah, or you just have a lot of emotions. You know, it's not necessarily about like instability. It's just when you have a lot of emotions, and as a person, when you grow up, I mean, some people are really high functioning. Like I feel very emotional most of the times, but I'm very high functioning. But it's just like at some point, your body starts to tell you.
Your body tells you when it's enough, right?
Yeah,
and you gotta listen to your body. Which
I don't
many
think
people
do enough
don't
do. That. Yeah.
I don't do enough of that. And you know what? I'm guilty of that too, of not listening to my body.
But it's great having these outlets though. Like, Yeah, like you said, writing poetry and for Jackie filmmaking, mm-hmm. I think it's really great. And I think hopefully that other people can also see this and, you know, be more open about it. Because I think we're at this point in time in life, we're ready to just be like free, flying like birds and not be like boggling up all these damn emotions, you know?
Life's too short for that. Yeah.
So we have a little break right now. And after the break, we will play a song by Teta Diana. She's a Rwandan artist. She's incredible. Her music is awesome. And she actually sang this song, Ndaje, at like a bunch of different events and during one of the commemorations of the Rwandan genocide. It's really great. So don't go anywhere. We have a little break and then you will be listening to Teta Diana. Woo!
Victoria Weekend goes live at Club Soda on Sunday, May 19th with A Taste of Reggae. One amazing concert featuring three incredible live bands jamming at Club Soda on Victoria Holiday Weekend, Sunday, May 19th. Doors open at 7 p.m. Performing will be Meta and the Cornerstones alongside Ilem and Inus Aso. This is a show you will not want to miss.
Hello, I'm Rich Jason. Do you think all electronic music is the same? On Rigged Sessions, we play everything, from the most energetic to the calm, from the euphoric to the gloomy, from the cutting edge of the music scene to tracks that have stood the test of time, from 100 BPM to 180 BPM, and everything in between. Plus, you'll get to listen to a weekly mix performed live by me. Rigged Sessions is on air every Thursday from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock PM Eastern, live only on CJLO 1690 AM and on CJLO.com.
Ngejira nembabwire icyo nsaba jyewe n'umuryango bene kanyarwanda turi umwe bashimureke kwita na rubanda mumbaka nyagatoya tegye amatwi mbahuze naje nirengagize ubwo buto bwanjye igikurumba ni impanuro basangira ibere n'ibanga umurage rumwe bikabaza biratinda uwakanaraza ntiyabishima biramuhanda nibwo duhenze tumena ibanga atubera umuhanga wo kudutanya
Yeah.
yakambira kumwana wari yatinda kwiba kurwatubyaye ntacyo rutwima oyu mururu wumba nukaturange yeah 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 unyemerere banure icyo dupfa nakiruta icyo dupfa gira neza uzabiturwa kandi nugira nabi bizakugora
Hello, this is Christina. You are listening to Sparkling Introspection on CJLO 1690 AM.
Woo! And this is Erdine. So that was a really beautiful song. I hope you all agree. It's by Teta Diana. She is a Rwandan singer-songwriter. And this song was called Ndaje. She was born in Kenya and raised in Uganda before returning to Rwanda after the 94 genocide. And she, actually this song, Ndaje, she has sung it at numerous events and world assemblies. She sang it for the 20th commemoration of the genocide. And this song has received multiple awards. And I think it was a really, really beautiful song. So
beautiful. Yeah. She has such a beautiful voice. It's gorgeous. Yeah. So back to the article I was talking to you about on The Atlantic. I just want to talk more about the importance of trauma and how to carry on from that trauma, right? So this woman, Conceline Shimwe, who had been raped and who had witnessed her brothers and father getting killed during the genocide, she, for the longest time, she was in denial, right? She didn't want to talk about her pain, her suffering. She closed herself off for so long. And I was thinking, like, how did she get help? Like, how do you help somebody who's in such a vulnerable, painful state like that? So it took her years, and like once she moved to New York, she actually got help. She went to see a psychotherapist, and when she was raped, she contracted HIV. So she began the testing for that. And I just like what a life. Like how are you normal after something like that? You know, and it's just her entire attitude towards everything was like, you know, it's okay. Like there are worse things in life. You just have to.
Well, I mean, I don't know if that's exactly her attitude. Yeah, just be like, oh, it's okay.
I'm
there
sure,
are worse
yeah.
things.
Like, well, she even said she has days where she cries all day and, you know, she's just, you know, like in pieces.
Yeah.
But then she has other days where she's so happy and joyous and just happy to be alive, happy to be, you know, surviving, thriving. It's just like this whole mix of emotions that really got to me. And I feel like it's probably eating at her, right?
I mean,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't, you don't, like this is like, if I was trying to think about myself in that situation and I don't know how I would carry on from that. I don't know how I would.
I mean, I think it's also each person deal with trauma and experience trauma in so many different ways.
Yeah.
And we can't obviously just sit here. We are obviously speaking from such a privileged position. We can't sit here and say, oh, I can imagine how she feels. Wow, like she must be going through this. I mean, what we're just reading this interview, and just the fact that we read this interview and from just words, we can feel the immense pain that she must have experienced in her life. And it's just not, it's not only her, it's many other people who are also affected and who are living with this. And it just goes on to speak volumes about the everlasting effect of trauma. And I think it's you're really right, Christina, to talk about like, trauma is not something that we deal with overnight and get over.
You
it's something we
cannot take
have to
it lightly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's something that we constantly have to work on, constantly have to improve. There's one quote in particular that from the article that really hits home. Frank Ochberg, he's a psychiatrist at Michigan State University. He said that when we face terror, this is a quote, our bodies shut down and desensitize us to the experience. We can tolerate being nearly eaten alive. We can tolerate seeing other members of our species eaten alive. It's in our biology. It's what happens afterward that can mean the difference between a healthy or unhealthy individual and between a robust or internally warring society.
End quote.
End quote.
Yeah.
Now, I mean,
that's a lot.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it's, we have to, when we experience pain, yes, it's horrible. It's out of our control. It's out of our hands. But what is in our control is what happens afterwards, is the repercussions, how we deal with it, right?
Yeah, so for ourselves, within ourselves.
Yeah, we're the pilots of our lives, right?
Yeah.
Oh, so no. We have to find a way to, you know, spring back from what we've experienced, right? We have to...
God, no one taught me how to be a pilot, and I can't
drive because you first
Because
you first have to be, right? You have to experience the pain, put your finger on it, find a way to deal with it, and then, you know, you become resilient.
Yeah. So this was a lot, today's topic.
Yeah.
Thank you everyone who's listening to us for sticking with us, for having the patience. I know I always say this, we have a little technical difficulties here and there, but we are getting better. This is our third show. Next week will be even better. And again, thank you to Jackie so much for coming on the show, taking time out of your day to talk about your personal story and to share your project Genny with all of us. Really wish you all the best. Everyone, please go to GoFundMe, support a female-centered project. Just before we go, I want to end on a really good note.
Yay.
Recently, there was the black hole photo that was like the first ever in the world. We got a picture of the black hole, and the algorithm development team was led by a female, Dr. Katie Bowman. Yes, girl.
Girl power.
Women are just making things happen. But
I love it.
Yeah. Anyways.
I love it. Blaze the trail.
Exactly. We are blazing the trail here somehow, I guess.
One technical difficulty at a time.
There you go. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, please come listen to us next Thursday at 10 p.m. on CGLO.com. You've been listening to Sparkling Introspection with Erdine and Christina. And again, catch us on 1629 CGLO, Sparkling Introspection.
Thursdays at 10.
Here is 9 to 5 by Dolly Parton. Good night, y'all.
Good night.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. In the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets, the traffic starts jumping.